Finance will come back to order, and we'll convene the joint Senate and House hearing. We'll continue our attendance from this morning. Representative Meyer, if you would introduce the House members.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to. We have Representative Kelly, Representative Holm, Representative Kurtula, Representative Hawker, Representative Wyrock. Those are the finance members here, and I believe we also have Representative Samuels, Representative Olson, Representative Newman,
Seaton,
Representative Crawford, Representative Croft, Representative Coghill, and Representative Seaton. Mm-hmm. Did I miss anybody?
Gardner.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Gardner, right there. Yeah. Sure.
Thank you.
And the Senate has been joined by Senator Seekins, Senator Gary Stevens, and I think that's all for now. It's Senator Ben Stevens. Senator Seekins, you may want to come get a chair over here, and so you'd be able to catch the PowerPoint presentation. We are meeting today to hear a presentation on the profit-sharing production tax and some other unique things being discussed by the administration at this time. For purposes of today's meeting, if you would please write down your questions and your references as we go through this presentation. It's divided into three parts, and the speakers and I have decided that the way this is set up, it would be easier to go through the entire presentation and then address questions, because I think you're going to find that in the course of the day, most of your questions are going to be addressed somewhat. And if you need further details after that point, they will be happy to address those questions. And and Commissioner Corbis is going to do the introductions today and get us started off. Commissioner?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm pleased to be here representing the administration to introduce our two speakers, Dr. Pedro Van Meurs and Roger Marks. Before that, doing that, I'd like to make a couple of comments. As we all seen in recent weeks, much attention is focused on reforming oil taxes in Alaska. We hope through today's presentation to provide you with more information on what oil tax reform would mean for Alaska and Alaskans. We must reform our oil tax system. The current production tax system, with its ELF exclusions, is no longer working for Alaska, particularly in the era of high prices. In the year 2020, only 1 in 5 barrels will be taxed. Most Alaskans and most lawmakers realize that the current system is flawed, as exemplified by the fact that Kuparik, the nation's second largest oil field, pays no tax starting this year. Many have asked, how does this fit into the gas pipeline? And there has been much confusion on this issue. Let me make two important points. First and foremost, we must adopt an oil tax structure that is right for Alaska, irrespective of the future gas pipeline. Second, Alaska oil and gas tax structures have a significant impact on the economies of any oil or gas project. The current tax structure must be changed. Because of that, we must change it prior to a gas pipeline agreement, so that companies understand the state's tax regime before investing in a $20 billion project. There is an obvious connection between oil taxes and the gas pipeline, but a new tax regime must be adopted on its own merits, regardless of the gas pipeline negotiations. What we are suggesting is balanced but not punitive as some other proposals. The balance is based on three factors. What is a fair share on oil? based on what the producers are already paying in similarly situated oil regimes around the world. What incentives are needed to induce exploration, investment, and reinvestment in Alaska? And what is needed to protect explorers and independents and small operators? We are still working with the producers, independents, the legislature's consultants, and knowledgeable legislators to make sure we construct a profit-sharing production tax bill that works for Alaska. A production-sharing tax system will provide revenue we can use now to improve our schools, build our communities, and shape our future. I'd like to now introduce our two speakers today. Dr. Pedro Van Yeers is an international oil consultant, has been working for the state of Alaska since 1996. He has a PhD in petroleum economics from the Dutch university system. He represents only governments in providing advice on oil and tax regimes, oil and gas tax regimes. We also have with us Roger Marks, who has been a petroleum economist with the Department of Revenue since 1983. He's been in the trenches all along for a complete change in our tax system since he arrived here, and is the detailed man doing most of our financial analysis. Dr. Van Yeers is going to start out with a production on the mechanics of the profit-sharing production system, followed by Mr. Marks, who will review the financial impact from a range of assumptions assuming a production sharing system. And finally, Dr. Van Yeers will provide some comparative information on how the production profit sharing system compares with other tax systems around the world. Dr. Van Yeers.
Thank you, Commissioner and Chairman. Great pleasure to be here in this very important committee. What I like to do is start out presenting a few slides that I already presented to the Resource Committee, but that is a very important lead-in to our further discussions, because I hadn't had the pleasure to discuss those earlier slides with this committee. The fiscal system of Alaska for oil and for gas, of course, has four main components: the royalties, the production tax, sometimes called severance tax, sometimes people even call it ELF because of the formula. Then we have property taxes and the state corporate income tax. If we look at the economics of investing in Alaska, then we have to be mindful that in addition to the Alaska fiscal terms, there is, of course, federal corporate income tax that companies are also subject to. The presentation that we will give, the three presentations that we will give today, are related to the proposed changes in the production tax. The current production tax for oil, we will concentrate mainly on oil in this presentation, is 12.25% during the first 5 years of production, and then 15% thereafter. And these percentages are then multiplied by the so-called economic limit factor, which is a factor between 0 and 1. Or in other words, if the factor is 0, then the tax rate is 0%. If the factor is 1, then the tax rate is 15% in the later years. The purpose of this ELF was to lower the production tax rate for smaller fields and with fields with low well productivity. The formula, the ELF concept, was developed in 1989. At the time, it really reflected the economic conditions that were present at the time. 300 barrels a day was considered a marginal well. In those days, there were only kind of about six oil fields. 150,000 was considered kind of a marginal oil field with the low prices we had in those years. And consequently, the ELF formula has worked well for the conditions of 1989. Subsequently, we have seen the development of a lot of satellite fields, which kind of changed the dimensions. Initially, the tax really helped and stimulate the development of small fields. However, as we will shortly demonstrate, the benchmarks are now completely outdated. And therefore, an overhaul of the production tax is in the interest of the state. There are four really serious deficiencies with the production tax. No longer, the ELF formula itself is no longer rational in relationship to well productivity and field production. The ELF is not responding to field production decline. ELF does, as we currently vividly experience, the ELF does not provide for a reasonable balance under a range of oil prices. If the ELF is zero, it will stay zero no matter whether the oil price is $60 a barrel. And the ELF does not provide for sufficient incentive to reinvest. So these are the four issues that we hope to tackle in the new structure. Just some examples of why is the current tax no longer effective. Here you see the ELF formula, a somewhat complex formula, but below the formula I have given actually some calculation results so that you can actually see what would come out. Say suppose a huge new field would be discovered that produced 6,000 barrels a day of oil with 2,000 wells in it, 300 barrels a day. Because of this formula, the ELF would be zero. So even if you discover a huge field today, 300 barrels a day at $60 a barrel or $40 or even $30 a barrel is a healthy level of production per well. So consequently, this means that even under those healthy conditions, no tax, even for a huge field. What you also see if you go kind of down the table there a little bit, take a 30,000 barrel a day field, for instance. If you have five wells, the ELF is relatively high, 0.55. If you have 20 wells, the ELF disappears. What this shows, the formula is just too sensitive to well productivity. And this may stimulate producers to simply keep every well flowing, because what counts is the number of wells. And consequently, this creates an environment where the ELF actually can decline faster than would be intended originally. So it is not a healthy situation that small numbers in wells kind of determine whether you have zero tax or whether you have a significant tax. The Kuparuk example was already provided by the commissioner, a very dramatic example. Here we have a very large oil field, a world-class oil field. And what do we see? The oil field peaked at about over 300,000 barrels a day. It is now at 150,000. It is declining to a still very healthy production rate of 100,000 barrels a day. And in that kind of blue line that you see here, this line here, you see the ELF decline to zero, as the commissioner said. That is just ridiculous, to have the biggest oil field, second biggest oil field in North America without production tax. That makes no sense to the state of Alaska. And consequently, it is for that reason that we are considering the new tax. Here you see a graph that is published in the revenue book of DOR. You see the forecast of Prudhoe Bay and all the other fields combined, 0.1L for all the other fields combined, so that means the tax rate will only be 1.5%, which is really a very low tax rate because there are many good fields in production. So it is for this reason that the tax is just fading out. We are having an ELF that is declining, we have oil prices that are increasing, and consequently that makes no longer sense to the state. And that is why the governor has proposed in a state to consider that we should consider the profit-sharing production tax, the PPT. This is would be a complete replacement of the current production tax. So we would repeal much of the provisions of the production tax and replace it with a new system. And the new system is meant to be based a law of general application, as the commissioner already indicated. How is the PPT calculated? The PPT is calculated by simply multiplying the tax rate by whatever the corporate cash flow is from the production in Alaska, from oil and gas. Then there are tax credits to encourage the investment. It is a consolidated tax at the corporate level. This is a very different concept than we have today. Today the tax is field by field, and that is precisely causing all these ELF problems and all these aggregation problems that we have had. This is a completely consolidated tax. And the tax is calculated on the cash flow, gross revenues, net of the royalties based on the wellhead prices, less the producer's lease expenditures. That is how the profits are being determined on which this tax is based. What is also important to consider is that there will be tax credits to encourage investment based on a percentage of the investment. If you have a loss in any year, and that's very important for new investors, if you have a loss in any year, that loss can be multiplied by the tax rate, and consequently, you can then claim a credit for that loss. Tax credits can be transferred and traded. And this means that later on in the third presentation, I'm going to come back on that a lot more in detail, how important that is to encourage explorers and independents. But this is a very important system to monetize your investment immediately. Yes.
Senator Stevens has asked for permission to make a statement.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Van Meers. I just want the committees to know that the rates that are going to come up on page 12,
yes,
those scenarios that you're going to present are the result of my request to the administration and to you to give us numbers so that we can do some comparison on certain fields in production versus the status quo. So I just want the members to know that the numbers that are Mr. Van Meers is going to show are at our request that we put forward last Friday. And I appreciate you taking the time over the weekend and first part of this week to run these scenarios for us. I just want to thank you, Madam Chairman. Yes.
Thank you very much, Senator Stevens. It was a great pleasure to respond to the request and give more kind of dimension to the importance of this tax in figures, because many people think in figures rather than in words, and that is very important for the state. Here you see actually the figures that were requested. That was suggested during my last presentation for the Resource Committee. We just talked in words, we didn't mention figures. Here you see a range of figures for tax rates. 25%, 20%, 17.5%, and then tax credit rates, we did sensitivity on the 15% and 20%. Now, basically, this is a reasonable range in my view, so consequently, it was a great pleasure to do the analysis on this range. And consequently, that is the purpose of this presentation, to give you a feel for how this PPT would work, how much it would actually bring in under different levels of tax, different levels of tax credits, so that you can then look at that as background information for your deliberations. We also have defined a little bit more the comment that I made in the previous presentation for small producers. The small producers are a very important component of the Alaska scene, and consequently what we are trying to do is give the small producers an opportunity to really participate in Alaska and really encourage them to invest in Alaska. And consequently, small producers often have important hurdles to overcome. They have access problems, they have other problems that they often have to deal with, and consequently, it is fair to create a level playing field. And what we hope to do is create that level playing field by giving the smaller producers a special tax benefit. That can be structured in different ways. It can be structured by, for instance, stating that the first 5,000 barrels a day would be 0% tax, for instance. Or we could say maybe the first 50 million per year or 100 million per year in corporate profits should be 0% tax. This would mean that, for instance, many of the smaller producers in Cook Inlet would not be subject to this PPT. So consequently, that's an important consideration for the small producers. We're also looking at heavy oil. A very important resource in the North Slope is precisely the heavy oil. It is in still in relative state of undevelopment. It is still a resource that represents the future of possible oil production in the North Slope. And consequently, heavy oil around the world is being considered as a resource that needs special tax considerations. And consequently, what we are considering at this point in time is to see whether maybe for heavy oil, the tax credits, for instance, could be somewhat higher than for normal conventional operations. We are still looking at this. We like to define better what precisely is heavy oil. We like to define better how would you qualify capital expenditures for heavy oil. But I think the concept is a worthwhile concept, and that is why I like to present it here as an idea that merits a consideration. Of course, we believe that the PPT enhances the investments. The whole idea is to provide greater incentives, particularly for the smaller producers, through the PPT to invest in Alaska together with the gas line. That will hopefully create Alaska as a whole new core area for investment by a wide variety of oil companies. In conclusion, the current ELF is based on is of course based on well productivity and production, and is completely outdated, as we indicated. It's no longer in the interest of Alaska. We have to do something new. It is proposed to have a profit-based system where we fairly share in the profits. If the oil prices are high, we get a good share. If the oil prices are low, we get a low share or nothing. And consequently, that is a very important concept, to fairly share with the investors this tax, rather than having a tax that is determined on some formula that is maybe keyed in at a certain point in time based on certain assumptions that then, after a few years, don't prove to be valid. So that is the conclusion. What we now have is Roger Marks has done extensive analysis of what these various tax rates and tax credit rates mean for the state in actual figures. So what I'm going to do is now put forward Roger's presentation, and then you will see a very interesting set of numbers.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. My name is Roger Marks. I'm an economist with the Department of Revenue. And what I'm going to present is a series of quantitative analyses of the PPT at different combinations of tax rates and credit rates. Just to sum up Dr. Van Muir's summary of just how the PPT works, it starts out with the wellhead value. And the wellhead value is the market price less the transportation costs. For instance, if the West Coast price of Alaska North Slope ANS crude is $50, and the marine transportation from Valdez is $2, and the TAPS tariff is $3, the value at the wellhead would be the $50 minus the $5 or $45. It's sometimes called the netback value as well. The wellhead value right now is the basis of the current tax, which is subject to the nominal 15% rate and the ELF. What the PPT, the goal of that is to actually bring in the upstream costs as well and recognize the full economics of production. And once you take the wellhead value and subtract these upstream costs, the operating costs, property tax, royalty is deductible under the status quo already, and capital costs subject to a tax rate of X and a credit on the capital costs of Y. And we're going to analyze the five fiscal scenarios requested by the committee that Dr. Van Muir's put up a few minutes ago. Before we start out, it's useful probably to explain a little bit about the modeling we did and some of the assumptions behind it. Of course, besides, you know, price, one of the most important components of how much money a tax will bring in is how much oil there's going to be. And that's, we looked at a long period here, about 45 years out to 2050, and of course that's very difficult to forecast how much oil there's going to be. In addition, in the case of the status quo, forecasting the ELF itself is very difficult because it depends on forecasting well numbers as well. When thinking about what future volumes might be, there are two significant parameters we've looked at. Number one, we can imagine a future where there's enhanced exploration and success and production. We call that the enhanced volume scenario. With that, what we had was a series of eight analogs to the Alpine field coming on spaced 5 years apart over the next 45 years. And then the other parameter is whether or not there's a gas line. And the way the gas line affects oil volumes, there are three important ways. One, at Prudhoe Bay, because of the decline in oil pressure from producing gas out of the field, initially there would be less oil at Prudhoe Bay, but with combined with the economics of the gas line, there'd be extended field life and more oil. We believe, or our assumption is, without a gas line, Prudhoe Bay shuts down in 2030. In addition, with a gas line, we believe the Point Thompson field comes on as well. And also, with a gas line, we believe there'll be a lot of additional exploration for gas. And with new gas fields, there'll be oil associated with that. So depending on whether or not you have enhanced volumes or whether or not you have a gas line, you could have four different volume scenarios. What we're going to present here is sort of the bookends. The low volume scenario, which is no enhanced volumes, no gas line, and the high volume scenario with a gas line and enhanced volumes. We believe it's not unreasonable to think that without the enhanced volumes and without a gas line that the whole North Slope could shut down in 2030. So in the low volume scenario, we go out to 2030. In the high volume scenario, we go out to 2050. This shows the difference in the volume scenarios there. In the high volume scenario, about 10.5 billion barrels gets produced between now and 2050. In the low volume scenario, 6.5 billion barrels get produced between now and 2030. A little bit about our assumptions on costs and prices, because again, that's a big component on how much money the PPT will bring in. We have access to lots of sources of data on costs. We have access to federal tax returns, property tax assessments, corporate financial statements, special reports. And this is our sort of general estimate of best estimate of what capital costs might be. Just quickly, we assume $100 million a year in exploration costs, and all these costs are in $2,005 dollars and escalate at 2% a year per assumption. We have $1 a barrel of what we call ongoing capital costs that are necessary just to keep the field producing. On existing fields, we believe a huge chunk of all future oil on existing field is going to depend on ongoing capital investments. So on existing fields, we assume 2/3 of all future barrels will incur a $4 a barrel developmental capital charge. And on new fields, all barrels get a $4 per barrel developmental capital charge, and our operating costs are also $4 a barrel. Again, the prices we're going to show are in real $2,005 dollars that escalate at 2% a year. We're going to show the annual revenues under these different fiscal scenarios, but before we do that, just for a snapshot, we want to show the cumulative revenues over the forecast period. For the low volume scenario, again, we go out through 2030. For the high volume scenario, we go out through 2050. 45 years is certainly a long time, but we went out that long because it accentuates the difference between the volume scenario and accentuates the long-term trends associated with both the current and proposed production tax structures. What we're going to show is a series of graphs. This graph here shows the cumulative revenues at different ANS prices in the low volume scenario. You'll notice the legend on the bottom. There are six lines there. The first one for the status quo, which is the bottom line on the graph. And then moving down, 2515 means the scenario of a 25% tax rate and a 15% credit, et cetera. And these are all in nominal dollars. What you'll notice, not only in this graph, but in all the graphs we're going to show, that you'll see pairs of lines together. And what this essentially displays is that the money we get is a lot more sensitive to the tax rate than to the credit rate. What you see, the top two lines that are together show 25% with a 15% credit and a 25% rate with a 20% credit. So it's the... Again, it's the credits are certainly important, especially given the time value of money since they're incurred early. But in terms of nominal revenues, it appears that the tax rate is certainly a bigger influence here. And two other things we want to point out, again, not only in this slide, but in all these slides. One, there's a lot of interest in what is the crossover point. At low prices, this tax is going to bring in less than under the status quo, and at high prices, more. And people want to know, well, what's that price? Well, as you see here, there's you know, depending on which particular fiscal combination you get, in this particular slide, the crossover point looks in the low to mid 20s. But I guess one thing we want to caution people about is not to obsess too much on the crossover point. Because what's also important is the slope of that line after it crosses. You'd think, gee, a low crossover point, I mean, say the crossover point was very low, say $10. We say, gee, at $10, everything over $10, we start making money. That would be true, but what would also be important is, well, at $65, are you making a little bit more money than under the status quo or a lot more money? And that depends on the slope. So, again, don't obsess solely on the crossover point. Think also about the slope of the line after it crosses. And then one other thing to keep in mind, you know, as we make these comparisons between these scenarios and the status quo, you know, given what Dr. Van Muir has just presented about the current ELF structure, that ELF structure is a pretty modest standard of comparison. So keep that in mind as well. So anyway, this is the low volume scenario, and between $15 and $65 over the next 25 years, depending on the price, total revenues of anywhere from $3 billion less to $61 billion more, depending on price. Figure 3, the next slide, shows the same information, but this is the high volume scenario. Now notice, again, the scale on the left, that's billions of dollars. Notice, if you go to the previous slide, again, that went up to 80 billion. This one goes up to 160 billion because we have more oil going out over a longer period of time. And you know, again, depending on going from $15 to $65, total revenues of $6 billion less to $134 billion more. We're next going to present the annual revenues. We're going to present them for, again, for the low volume and the high volume scenario at ANS prices of $20, $40, and $60. Just you can see what happens year after year. This is the $20 scenario, the low volume scenario at $20. And make no mistake about it, that top line there is the status quo. At low prices, we make less money. Anywhere from $100 million to $180 million less a year, depending on which fiscal scenario you're looking at. This is $40 here, figure five. At $40, we make between, depending on the scenario, we're over the crossover point here, we're making money, anywhere from $400 million to $900 million a year more average. And you know, if you compare the $20 slide we just showed to this one, you know, and at you know at the money we make at $40 is more than what we would lose for 4 years at $20. I don't know if that, I'll say it again. The money we would make at $40 in 1 year is more than the money we would lose at $20 for 4 years. And then here it shows the $60 scenario, average annual revenues of $1 to $2 billion a year more than the status quo. Again, this is the low volume scenario, no gas line, no enhanced volumes. But what's interesting here is that these revenues are equivalent to how much money we would make with a gas line at a $5 per million BTU market price in Chicago. So, under this scenario, you're getting gas line revenues without a gas line, and at prices less than what they are today. I mean, who knows what prices are going to be in the future, but interesting. The next series of slides are the high volume scenarios with the gas line and with the enhanced volumes. These revenues do not include the money we receive from the gas severance tax, which hopefully is part of the Serena gas contract. So these revenues represent the oil revenues. Now, as we envision the PPT working, if there was a gas line, if the severance tax was received in kind per the Serena Gas Act, the upstream gas costs would be deductible upstream costs for the PPT. So this includes the gas line costs, but the gas line revenues are not here, but are received per the for our in-kind marketing receipts per the Stranded Gas Act. So at this scenario, at $20, again, we lose money between $150 and $200 million a year. Here's the $40 scenario. Again, this is the high volume scenario. At $40, average annual revenues of 0.6 billion to 1.2 billion per year, more than the status quo. Figure nine. The $60 scenario, average annual revenues $1.5 to $2.5 billion more than the status quo. Next, we'd like to look at what the effective tax rates would be under the PPT for the low and high volume scenario. This is the low volume scenario. And what we see here is indeed this is creates a progressive system. Even though we have a flat tax rate of 20%, because your upstream costs are deductible and those costs are a smaller percentage of the value as prices go up, you actually end up with an effective tax rate. I mean, we actually end up with a progressive effective tax rate. How we define the effective tax rate is the severance tax revenue divided by the wellhead value less royalty. And you also notice under the status quo, it's flat. It's about 4%, whether prices are $15 or whether prices are $65. And for those of you who are familiar with the original history of the ELF going back to 1977 as originally proposed into the legislature, it was originally structured so that what would be deductible at any given price was the operating costs you needed to recover your operating costs at the price of oil for the month you're paying the tax. And this is really how the original ELF was intended to work, at a progressive rate. So here you see under the low volume scenario, depending on which one you're looking at, you know, at $65 a barrel, the effective tax rates they'll creep up between 10 and 16%. And go up very slowly at a price of infinity. It would be 20%. Here's the effective tax rate in the high volume scenario. Again, there are higher effective tax rates. Again, depending on scenario, at $65, between 12 and 18%. And finally, to conclude, and as a transition to Dr. Van Muir's next presentation, where he presents the PPT in the context of international competitiveness, just want to talk a little bit about what the PPT does to corporate take. Now, if you look at the Department of Energy Information Administration's their long-term forecast. For what it's worth, you know, it's of course it's not going to be correct, but their current forecast, which is not unreasonable, in the circle of all forecasts, is long term prices equivalent an ANS equivalent of $58 a barrel in 2004. Now, what eventually could happen will definitely be higher or lower than that. But that's not an unreasonable forecast given today's climate on what future outlook looks like. Given our high volume scenario and this forecasted price over the 45 years, that would literally generate $1 trillion of gross revenues to the North Slope. And what we'd like to look at is looking at how corporate take would be affected under that scenario with the status quo and the PPT and the elements of corporate take. So 100% of that $1 trillion, what comes out of that is the capital and operating and transportation and property taxes and royalties. And then if you focus on the bottom three chunks there, the third chunk from the bottom is the severance tax. That's the one that's bright yellow. And as you can see, as you go from the status quo to the PPT, the severance tax has increased. But then interestingly enough, if you look at the next chunk, that's the federal corporate income tax. Well, that's a lot smaller under the PPT. So what happens is the federal government is picking up the tab on a third of the PPT. And then the bottom chunk is the corporate take, and you see how that's affected. It goes from you're looking at gross revenues to $1 trillion. It goes from 39% to 33% of the gross revenues. If you're looking at the economic rent or the pre-tax profits, it goes from 51% to 44%. Now we've presented some numbers that a lot more, we're going to get a lot more money from this given what tax rate and credit rate might come out of this if anything comes out of it. How big a hit would that be to the producers? What you're seeing here is of the $1 trillion, they would get 6% less and walk away with 33% of $1 trillion, which is $333 billion. And the question you need to ask yourself is that painful or not to walk away with $333 billion? And in addition, again, emphasize what we said about the status quo, that the ELF is a modest standard of comparison. So that concludes my remarks, and we're going to turn over to Dr. Van Muir's. He will talk about the context of this proposal in international competitiveness. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Roger. As Roger demonstrated, without doubt, I think, is that if you are in the range of the taxes that are that were requested for economic analysis, as you can see, actually, you're really talking about an amount of revenues that could be equal to the whole gas line. So this oil tax that's being considered is not a minor thing. This is equal to the whole gas line. There's the only difference that it comes in right away rather than having to wait for the gas line coming on stream. So this is an immense amount of cash if these rates would be applied. And then the question becomes, is this reasonable? How does this compare with international conditions? How would that affect the attractiveness of exploration and of production? How would this work? Is this in the ballpark? And that is what I hope to demonstrate today. I will discuss today in some detail how this fits kind of in the international scene and why this range is actually a reasonable ballpark, I think. The situation in the international market has, without dwelling too much on all the trends internationally, has changed very dramatically. As you know, I'm all over the world working in many countries, and there are really two countries in the world, really two style of countries in the world. One, kind of the progressive countries, and the progressive countries, what does that mean? That means that they have deals or production sharing or contracts or taxes whereby it is already agreed beforehand that taxes will go up very significantly with price or other profitability indicators. Take Russia, for instance. If the price is low, they have something that would be equivalent to a PPT of 10%. But if the price goes high, it automatically becomes 70%. And that deal is already done. So they did those deals, say, in the early 90s. And consequently, there is a lot of deals like that in the world whereby the government take what the share that the government gets from the total significantly increases with price. Automatically, not negotiated, not legislated, automatically, because that's in the contract or that is already in the law. And there's a large number of countries that oil companies work in, that also work in Alaska, where these systems are in place, such as Angola, for instance, a major area of activity, Russia, you know Sakhalin here very well, very good connections with Sakhalin and Alaska, Azerbaijan, Libya, Norway, Alberta in its oil sands, Indonesia in some contracts. So there are many countries that actually already thought through the concept that oil prices may go off very significantly, and the contracts or the legislation already provide for an automatic increase in the share of the government if that happens. Now, there are also jurisdictions like Alaska today where that is not the case. And consequently, that are the regressive neutral countries whereby the government take or the share of the government kind of stays more or less the same, regardless of the price, or even declines, as it is the case of Alaska. So what is happening? Of course, the countries that have these systems that didn't have the formulas for the higher prices, they now feel behind. They now feel that they're having a bad deal. So what is happening around the world, here is already five examples of countries that over the last year, during 2005, already with new legislation or new contracts, increased their take, increased their government share. So a number of countries are simply saying, with these high oil prices, we should get more. The most remarkable example actually was the UK in December, where the government indicated that the government share should go up from 40% to 50%, so a 10% increase. If you look, say, at Roger's last graph, we are actually only talking about a 6% difference. So UK actually made a more aggressive move than came out of the graph of Roger. Other nations as well, Trinidad, Tobago, Kazakhstan, Bolivia has a new petroleum law introduced. Venezuela used to have a royalty tax credit, which they completely eliminated. So many countries already took the steps and say, with these high oil prices, we are going to collect more. So that is a worldwide trend now, either because the formulas were already negotiated or countries decide that it is fair to get a better share under the higher oil prices. So what I did then is I analyzed the PPT from the concept of an investor. How would an investor look at this new package? What would it mean to? And I looked at all kinds of field sizes and well productivities and so on. And then I also analyzed it from two perspectives. Remember, we are contemplating this special allowance for new investors, for first-time investors, say of the 5,000 barrels a day free. That has an enormous impact on someone who looks at Alaska for the very first time, particularly companies that would come down here. And consequently, I analyzed it with and without that allowance to look in the mind of new investors and in the mind of investors that are already here and that wouldn't benefit on an incremental basis from that allowance. Here you see a small field, a 50 million barrel field, on a reinvestment basis. So suppose a large oil company already existing in Alaska would look at a 50 million barrel field. What would happen? Now, under the current system, zero ELF, so the ELF would be zero. Under the proposed system, PPT would become positive in WTI. I use WTI, that is about $2 higher than Roger's graphs. Oil prices, you see here that somewhere between 26 and 32, you have a crossover point, depending on the fiscal system that would be picked. So that is what you see there. You see also negative, that means if the field is very unattractive, for instance, $22 a barrel, this is $22 a barrel, say WTI, so you have to deduct about $7 to get to the wellhead, so that is $15 at the wellhead. I assumed about $13 cost, so this now becomes a very unprofitable field. So if it's a very unprofitable situation, then actually the tax credits will help that field. So this is a significant, so under very uneconomic conditions, there will be some tax credits and they can be traded with other oil companies. On a big field, I get graphs that look very similar to Roger's, but now this is just for a one-field case. If you look at another Alpine, or if you look at another big field, if you take in your mind, say, the reinvestment by a large oil company in large new fields, what you would see is that the new tax collects more almost under any kind of price level for any one of the scenarios that was requested. So. For any one of those scenarios, you would collect more. Here, this is probably the most interesting chart. This is what I call the Cook Inlet chart, because this is the chart for the small companies in the Cook Inlet. Now, what would happen there? This is the first investment chart, or this is an investment chart for a small company. A small company would not pay the tax. They would not pay the tax because we give them this allowance. But they still get the credits. Now think about that. They would still get the credits. Now take the 2015 example. How much would they get? 20% on the losses plus 15% for the capital investment. So that means the credits that they can trade lower their capital cost by 35%. Now, if you want to give an incentive to look at Cook Inlet again, this is the way to do it. So that is what we have here. So new small oil companies would look with new eyes at their smaller targets, maybe small targets in the North Slopes, small targets in Kula, and first investors would see a very attractive system to come in. Of course, if you are a first investor, a large oil company, say suppose Petrobras would come to Alaska and would look at large targets, then of course they will discover that even with that allowance on the large field, that allowance doesn't mean very much. With that allowance on the large field, they pay more tax. Now you would say, if you pay more tax, that must be less attractive. Of course, in a sense, it is. Of course, if you pay more tax, that means less corporate cash flow. And that is an unattractive aspect of these tax. But what we have also done, and that makes this proposal so interesting, what we have also done with these tax credits, we have also modified the cash flow. We have modified, we have lowered the initial investment required. And consequently, actually, what we discover, and that is what you see here, if you apply the new PPT, the rate of return actually goes up, despite the higher taxes. The rate of return actually goes up. The blue line that you see there, this blue line, let me see there, the blue line at the bottom, that is the current system. Then the yellow line is if you would reinvest without the benefits. The purple line or the pink line there is the line that you would get if you are a first investor. So no matter what, your rate of return goes up on a small field as well as a big field. And why is that? That's because of the tax credits. That's because your investment costs you less, and because your net investment costs you less, you can trade your tax credits, and consequently, your rate of return goes up. So that's a very important conclusion, and that means that companies who are interested in a strong rate of return would find that a very attractive aspect of this PPT. As I mentioned, I compared the PPT with competition in a number of countries. I took 8 countries in the study. I only picked countries where oil companies that are today in Alaska, large oil companies that are today in Alaska, are very active, because we want to compare with places where they actively invest. So that is Norway, UK, US Gulf, Alberta Oil Sand, Nigeria, Angola, Russia, and Azerbaijan. Now, just to make the graphs a little bit easier, because we have these 5 scenarios and we have 8 countries to compare with, just to make the graphs a little bit easier, what I did is I just picked the UK and Norway. Now, why did I pick the UK and Norway? Because the UK is a country that is a little bit on the low side in terms of total sharing, about 50%. Norway is on the high side of current sharing, that is about 78%. So that displays kind of the international spectrum of competition in government share that other nations have. So that is what you see here. On the graph, you see now the 5 scenarios that were requested, plus the current system, plus Norway, plus the UK. Now, let's look at that graph. It's a little bit difficult to interpret, so because there's so many lines on. But what you see there is Norway, that is that blocked line in the bottom. So they have this high government take. So the rate of return, IRR, means the rate of return on a first investment, is about equal to the current system. What you see is the significant improvement of any one of the scenarios relative to the current system. And then you see the UK still being a little bit higher than the current system on a very large field. Now, if you take a small field, actually the rate of returns become equal to Britain. Now, how did I do this? I actually took the British fiscal system and applied it to the Alaska cost conditions, and I took the Norwegian fiscal system and applied it to the Alaska cost conditions. So the cost and the revenues are exactly the same. Now, however, I made one very important adjustment to the fiscal system, and that is that netback of the wellhead price. I already mentioned that if you have WTI, that the price at the North Slope is actually $7 less. Now, in Norway, that's not the case. They are sitting right there in the middle of the market. So they get right away a higher price. Now, these graphs already correct for that. So these graphs already correct for the fact that the wellhead price in Alaska is much less than in Britain or the UK. Here you see the famous government take that Roger also talked about. Britain, as you can see, 50% government take on large fields. Norway, 78% government take on large fields. The PPT proposals, the current system is the yellow line. As you see, the yellow line is somewhat regressive. It starts at somewhat above 60%, and it goes down to about 55. Now, any one of those scenarios, as soon as the prices are somewhat higher than the low 20s, as also Roger explained, then you start to collect more. So we are adding another 5 percentage points or so to the government take with this proposal. As you can see, we are really not proposing anything completely out of the ordinary. We are still well within the range of international competition by doing this. So this is not something that would be a complete diversion or a complete change to international conditions. This is for big fields. Now, for the small fields, we actually lower the government take, as I indicated, the Cook Inlet case, and consequently, small fields, we are actually making equally attractive to Britain and much more attractive than the current ELF. So consequently, we give a modest improvement, but this is on a huge field, so it means a lot of dollars. That is where this $1 billion a year comes from, a lot of dollars, but a small percentage increase, the small fields, a lower government take. Now, what I also did is I did a competitiveness analysis. What is that? You can take, what I did is I took 48 economic criteria, different field sizes, different criteria like rate of return and net present value and so on. And then I rated the eight systems and the two Alaska systems. I picked one of them, two of the Alaska systems, from the best to the worst. Now, if you're the best out of 48 criteria, then you get 48 points because you're number one. And if you're the worst, you get 480 points because you are number 10 in 48 criteria. So that is easy to understand. Now, here you see the competition. The US Gulf would rate number 52. So that is actually almost the best system of all 10. U.S. Gulf is a very attractive system for North American oil companies, for any oil company investing in the U.S. Gulf, a low royalty, and then only the corporate income tax, and consequently, the U.S. Gulf would rate best in the world. Then comes the U.K., that this is the U.K. on the basis of the 50% with the increase. Then comes Alberta with the oil sands, a relatively attractive system. Then comes my Nigeria case. Then comes the Alaska PPT. This is for a first investment, for a new investor looking at Alaska. Then Angola, then Azerbaijan, then the current system in Alaska, then Norway, then Russia. So what you see here is, from a competitiveness point of view, for a new investor, my conclusion is that for a new investor, on average, Alaska would look far more competitive, far more attractive with the PPT than with the current system. Now, it is different for the companies that are already here. The companies that are already here don't get that 5,000, the large investors that are already here and that would reinvest. So you wouldn't, with your reinvestment, you wouldn't earn that 5,000 barrel a day allowance. So if you look at the international competition, say, for the next investment, for once you have already gotten your 5,000 barrels free, then Alaska PPT, of course, doesn't look as attractive as for a new investor. it looks still a little bit attractive. Whether companies would consider the PPT, whether the large three investors would consider the PPT attractive or not attractive, would depend very much on how they weigh rate of return and other profitability criteria relative to the government take, what kind of field sizes they're actually looking at, what kind of costs they're looking at. In some cases, it would come out better. In other cases, it may come out somewhat less. So for reinvestors, for the large oil companies that are already here and would consider reinvestment in Alaska, the system is somewhat better, I think, than the current system, but not dramatically better. And it really depends on how you look at the criteria, whether you would consider it somewhat better or about the same. So that is the analysis of the competition, the analysis of the economics, and therefore my conclusion is that the five scenarios that were requested for analysis, if the legislature would take any one of these cases, that from an international perspective that look like reasonably competitive cases, it encourage investment in the state, and consequently I believe therefore that the range that was requested seems to me a reasonable range from an international perspective. As we heard from Roger, this range would result in very large additional revenues under attractive oil prices, with the large scenario maybe as much as $1 billion a year. Very comparable to getting a gas project right away. So consequently, this is very important figures, very important conclusions, I think, that came out of the request from the senator. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Before we go on with questions, I do want to recognize that we've been joined by Senator Terrio and Senator French, and they've been here most of the time. Representative Meyer, you have additional members.
Yes, Madam Chair. Online we have the co-chair of finance, Mike Chenault, and Representative Foster is here. Representative Cott, Representative Roper, Representative Guerra was here. He's still here. Representative Guttenberg, and Representative Lynn, and Representative Thomas. I think we have almost the whole house here.
I think so. You have your quorum. Okay. Are there questions? Senator Bundy.
Thank you, and thank you for all the information. I think perhaps my question will go to Roger. One of the things that I hear anecdotally from folks, I'm not an accountant, I don't even play an accountant on TV, is that and maybe it's instructive that the Enron trial is going on right now, that a clever accountant and someone who had a lot of money could buy lots of clever accountants could hide profits. And what would Alaska's protection be from clever accounting? How do we assure that as people have said, if they had to pay a net profit tax, they'd make sure there was never a profit?
The reason I probably, Roger has been working very hard over the last few days on the economic model, and I had the benefit to actually study precisely the kind of details that you're just asking about. So consequently, the question is, yes, clever accountants could potentially maybe hive off profits and make the profits look smaller than they are. To begin with, profit-sharing systems are in place all over the world. So consequently, this is not if Alaska engages in a profit-sharing system, Norway has had it very successfully for decades. Alberta is successfully developing the tar sands with the system. And consequently, there is no widespread international experience to indicate that governments really get cheated, say, out of massive profits. However, that means, though, that you have to set up the administration in such a way that it is transparent, sufficiently transparent, and that the ground rules are clearly set out. Now, Alaska has already experience with that. Alaska has already net profit sharing leases today. So consequently, already today, Alaska is administering net profit sharing leases. There are extensive regulations that guide how the profits are being calculated today. So it is not something that would be completely new for Alaska. Alaska has already the experience of doing it. The experience with the net profit sharing leases, I think, is positive, and consequently, it shouldn't be too difficult to transpose this to a wider system. Is there always a possibility that someone, you know, finds ways to game the system or find? That's always the case. I don't know an international case where I have worked in many countries, and I have come across a number of cases where governments and companies disagree about the deductions and where you have a process for resolving your differences. And consequently, there is no question that a profit-sharing system would mean an expansion, say, of the Alaska experience in terms of monitoring net profit shares. There are ways of simplifying it. A very profitable way, a very easy way that some countries use is to simply use the joint venture billing systems that many companies have among themselves as a basis, and provided such a system, for instance, works well, that could be a very easy way to monitor, say, the revenues and the cost. But absolutely correct, if the state goes forward with anything like this, the PPT law needs to include a significant section to set out the ground rules for precisely how these profits are being determined. The experience around the world is, if you do your homework, if you properly set out what the rules are, if you have a clear and transparent system of evaluating that, you collect a very large percentage of the true profits.
And one follow-up, if I might. And I think Roger mentioned that if we guess wrong and oil prices tank, some of us were here when it was $9 a barrel, that in 1 year we'd make up what we lost in four. Is that?
Well, just compare $20 to $40, that would happen.
Yeah. And and it would seem to me then that, as current budget proposals show, every dollar that's available gets spent instantly. If we were going to have something like this, we would have to then have something in place that would capture some of that revenue for future possible downturns before we would want to move forward.
Well, that would not be imprudent.
Maybe impossible politically, but not imprudent.
Representative Weirock.
Thank you. Commissioner Corbis, you testified that Alaska's current tax structure must be changed before the state reaches an agreement on the gas pipeline. If the legislature adopts a profit-sharing production tax at a rate above 25% or below 17.5%, which are the numbers that you used in this analysis, is that PPT still conducive to proceeding with gas pipeline negotiations?
Let me correct that. The numbers that were used were at our request.
I understand. I just want to use that to bound the question, bound the problem.
I don't know the answer to the question. Excuse me. Through the chair, Representative Weirock, I don't know the answer to the question. It is our intent, for whatever is adopted by the legislature, that is what will be included in the gas pipeline negotiations.
Okay, then a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Since one-third of the major oil companies have already agreed with the state on the terms of the gas pipeline agreement, do we lose that agreement with that one company if we change from ELF to PTPT?
Could you repeat the question?
Sure. Since one-third of the companies have already agreed with the state on the terms of the gas pipeline agreement, do we lose that agreement with that one company if we change from ELF to PPT?
It's possible. The one company that has agreed to the gas pipeline agreement has not agreed on the PPT.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there other questions? Senator Terrio. Come join us.
Thank you. First of all, a question for Mr. Van Meers. And I think you touched on the fact that for heavy oil, you might actually have to have a different level of credit.
Correct.
So that basically acknowledges that even though heavy oil, the value because of the quality bank adjustments, it's not as valuable, it's more expensive to produce. So you're going to have more expense to deduct from your profit, and your profit in the first place, because the oil is worth less, is less. That dynamic alone is not enough to compensate for heavy oil.
As I mentioned, Senator, in my presentation, it is something that we are studying at the moment. We have not reached a firm conclusion on it. I just put it out there so that if we make further recommendations in the future, I have already put it here, and other legislators can also do their own analysis and maybe verify whether this is a useful concept or not. Now, you're absolutely correct in with the tax credits that would be given and the normal deductions under the PPT, the higher costs of the and the lower revenues of the heavy oil would already result in a lower level of profitability by definition. So consequently, that would then automatically result, contrary to the ELF, would automatically result in a lower level of profits and the PPT received. Many nations in the world evaluating this matter have come to the conclusion that heavy oils need further special fiscal incentive. Alberta has done so, Saskatchewan has done so, Venezuela has done so, Colombia, many of the nations in the world, Newfoundland is considering it as we speak. Many nations in the world have recognized that heavy oil is something that needs some extra protection. Whether it is justified, we haven't made up our mind yet. I'm just putting it out as a possible suggestion. We are studying the matter, so consequently, whether I would recommend, say, to the legislature or not, whether such a tax credit is useful depends a little bit more on some more work. But in principle, your question is correct. The PPT system automatically corrects already for the higher cost and the lower revenues. But sometimes for heavy oil, you need to do a little bit more.
Follow up?
Yes. And another question is, if part of what we're trying to help the companies with is to mitigate not only just return costs, but mitigate risk, how would you differentiate, or can you tell me if you have figured whether there should be a differentiation between, exploring way out from the existing infrastructure versus replacing piping or facilities that are in the existing fields? In the existing fields, you certainly have expenses. I mean, if you buy a new compressor or put in a new piece of pipe, that's expense. But there's very little risk. You know the reserve you're developing. You're going to put it right into the plant. There's not much risk with that. So are we compensating the companies the same way for that expenditure versus one that's far away where they're really taking a roll of the dice and looking for that next alpine or next elephant field?
No, you are entirely correct again that of course all capital investments do not have the same risk associated with it. Typically, we look a little bit broader. We look from the perspective of a new investor that would not just look at, replacing a pumping station, or we look at the whole exploration program and the possible investment in the development of the field as a totality. How does that look? Because that is what a new investor would really look at, and not just what cost my exploration well, but what is the whole economic cycle. or economic cycles for various leases or development projects. So that means that even in exploration, the fact that you give a tax credit on the subsequent capital investment makes the exploration considerably more attractive. So that is why our results show that with the introduction of the PPT and the tax credit, even if it is the same rate for exploration capital expenditures and equipment expenditures, exploration in general becomes far more attractive. Whether it is useful to distinguish between exploration capital expenditures or capital expenditures, that is certainly an area for fruitful consideration, but we haven't done analysis on that at this point in time.
A couple of questions. Mr. Marks, question for you, and one that I put to you before. You've done your calculations, you said, on a basic cost for finding the new oil, I think it was, for developing new oil, $4 per barrel. And I'm wondering how much of that is based on the historic prices, and if we've stepped up to now a new price paradigm for the commodity that allows the companies to spend more money than they have historically looking for the next field. Have you considered how much of that cost, you know, should we step up to something beyond $4 if that's historic price, or are you counting on technology advancements bring that cost down? How does that all play together? Have you run those numbers to come up with your $4, or is that just historical data?
Well, it is historical data, and in general, in commodities, when you see a run-up in price, there is a short-term reaction. There's a bigger demand to produce the commodity, and there's a short-term, because of demand for the resources to produce the commodity, there is a short-term inflationary effect. Historically, though, that effect is short-term, and looking at historical data on not only oil but all commodities, there is not a big long-term inflation effect as a result of run-up in price. It's short-term and then corrects itself because a lot of new entrants, because it becomes real profitable. And like any other business, there's a lot of money to be made and the supply increases to do it. And again, the technology effect is very important in the long term as well.
One last question. Commissioner Corbis, could you give us a clarification? I've had a couple of members from the governor's comments yesterday just ask whether it's anticipated that the administration will put in legislation if you get to a point that you're ready, or you're expecting the legislature. And could you just maybe give us a clarification on that?
The administration and members of the legislative leadership are discussing that at present and to determine the best way forward.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? Oh, Senator French.
Structure of this seems to be favoring smaller and more nimble companies, and I think that's a good idea. And I think the future of the Alaskan oil industry is actually in that direction. And the best example of that, the best historical example, is Cook Inlet, which is mostly by majors and now is mainly run by smaller companies. Have your models taken into account the idea that perhaps 5 or 10 years in the future, the three majors will no longer be operating or owning assets on the North Slope, and that those assets may have been distributed to 4, 5, or even 10 smaller companies that then begin to run the North Slope and would then be entitled to large tax credits under your proposal?
Yes, the proposal that we're making to favor smaller companies is very similar to what some other jurisdictions do around the world. The most interesting example has always been Alberta, which always had their small producers' royalty tax credits, whereby small producers actually received as much as 75% of their royalties back from the state. So Alberta has always had a very strong policy in order to encourage the smaller companies. And we took some inspiration from those ideas. Now, if you do that, of course, if you have legislation to that effect, you have to have certain protection that in the legislation and that exists in Alberta, and we would need to do the same thing, that a company not voluntarily kind of fractures into 100 little pieces in order to benefit from the deduction. Alberta manages that very well. It is not too difficult to have a particular approval procedure for new entrants to make sure that it is not done in order to essentially evade taxation. So the new legislation will look at that. You would need to have provisions in the new legislation, I would say anti-splitting legislation, with respect to companies. It's not too difficult to do. The effect, of course, I fully agree with your view that in a maturing oil province, oil province that is very gradually maturing, smaller companies gradually take an increasingly larger role. I mean, if you look at Alberta, which is one of the most mature oil provinces in the world, practically all the oil in Alberta is produced today by smaller companies, and the bigger companies are looking at the oil sand plants and the bigger investments. All of the oil companies have indicated, though, particularly the three majors that we're currently negotiating with in the Stranded Gas Act, and have declared so in public forums, that they also see for themselves a very large role for reinvestment in Alaska. So I don't expect the major oil companies to not continue their investment in Alaska. I think they hope to play a very large role still in the future of Alaska. So I don't see it as pessimistic that they will fade out over the next decade or so. So consequently, they see themselves as major investors. This is a very important core area for each of the three companies today. And what we hope is that as a result of the PPT and as a result of the gas line, there is more enthusiasm for the major oil companies to continue a strong presence in Alaska. So really, the state needs both. The state needs aggressive new smaller entrants that start to pick up the smaller pieces and start to develop the same kind of wealth in Alaska that has been developed in, say, Texas or in Oklahoma or in Alberta. But you also continue to need the larger oil companies that have to look at the bigger pieces, like large heavy oil developments, for instance, and maybe large developments like the Point Thompson development and so on. So it is a mix. I see for the next few decades still a mix, but the legislation would have to provide anti-splitting provisions. At the same time, the legislation would, of course, be a strong incentive for major oil companies to indeed see whether they can hive off certain pieces to smaller companies, because smaller companies are now in a better position to make more attractive offers to the major oil companies to maybe take smaller pieces on. And that's a good development. That would be a good development to have that, to have smaller companies make offers to certain aspects of the major oil company operation to see whether they can take on smaller tasks in the North Slope and other areas of Alaska. This legislation will encourage that strongly and will create a wider base of wealth among Alaskans than what we see today.
Senator Stevens. Ben Stevens.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Van Meers, I have some questions. refers to the same subject on this first investment in the small field on that page 7 of your proposal.
This box, yeah.
Versus. So, just to clarify, the term of this graph is the life of the field or an annual basis?
No, this is actually the graph. I should have explained that a little bit better. This graph is the total, payments that result from over the life of a field from a 50 million barrel field. So consequently, and the graph, it's somewhat difficult to read, but the graph is for different prices of oil.
Right.
So consequently, what you see here, that let's say to interpret the graph somewhat straightforward, that if you have any one of the five scenarios that you requested, what you see is that on average on a 50 million barrel field, companies, new investors, this is first investment, a new investor would see about $150 million worth of tax credits. That is what this graph actually is telling you. And consequently, that is, of course, an enormous incentive to go after these small fields. Up to 5,000, you wouldn't pay any tax, but you would benefit from the tax credit. So your economics would dramatically change in favor of small field development.
Right, but so just to clarify again, so that's over the life of production of the field?
The life of the production of the field, because if you assume that the small producer would never do any other field, then he would just get his tax credits, he would produce a field, he would pay the royalties, pay the corporate income tax, so it looks as if you're losing something here. Of course, in total, the state would still gain, but it would be a very strong incentive to develop a field like that from a PPT point of view.
I see. But so this differs from the current NPSL program, Mr. Marks, as the current NPSL leasing agreements have capital. Once capital cost recovery is achieved, then the tax structure kicks back in. Is that correct?
In the current net profit sharing leases, there is no similar mechanism proposing here, because of course there are no tax credits. So consequently, under the current profit sharing system, is you don't pay anything until you recovered all your investment, and then you start to pay the profit share. The same could happen here. The same could happen here if a producer voluntarily wants to take his carry forwards as tax credits and absorb it over time. He wouldn't pay tax for a long time. That is the same thing in this situation. But the big difference between the PPT and a normal net profit sharing lease is, with the PPT, we have tax credits. With a normal net profit sharing lease, you don't have a similar mechanism.
Tax credits that are tradable.
That are tradable, yes.
In addition, under the current net profit share system, until a field starts earning a profit, the unrecovered costs actually accrue interest,
yes,
as well, where we don't propose that under the PPT.
Thank you.
Senator Terrio.
As we learned from the Agouroq discussion, not only do your sunk costs, that account that you get to recoup, accrue interest, but it also accrues on every previous leaseholder, their sunk costs too, and you get to recapture all of those, whether they were your sunk costs or your previous owners. Would that same mechanism work? You said that it would not accrue any interest, but the previous owner's sunk costs, would that be recapturable?
Well, I'll start out. I mean, I think if there were an owner that sold its interests, if they had expended money and taken the credit, they would earn the credit as soon as they made the expenditure. Now, if they sell a credit, it's important within how the PPT is developed, either by statute or the regulations, to make sure that when assets are churned, that there's not double dipping on credits. And keenly aware of to make sure that doesn't happen. But certainly a person, once the PPT is in place, if a person makes an expenditure, the credit is realizable immediately.
Okay, so we shouldn't expect then a duplication of that same net profit, the current net profits cost recoupment mechanism in PPT, because like you said, the person gets the credit right away, so it's not going to accrue in an account.
Right. And under the MPSLs, I mean, again, the cost is only recovered once by whoever eventually the lessee is.
But maybe it is good to elaborate. Let's give a simple example. Let's say, suppose somebody buys a truck for exploration, a large truck for $100,000 or something. He gets, if the tax credit is 15%, he would get $15,000 tax credit. If he now sells that truck to a certain party, what would happen is that tax credits will be recouped by the seller. Now, the buyer of the truck can then claim it again, but the law would have to contemplate a recoupment mechanism of the seller of the asset, so that there is absolutely no double dipping anywhere along the whole chain. And that we are working on. There are a few alternative ways of doing that, and we are currently looking at that.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You may have already answered this, and I missed it, but how do we define a tax credit? For example, is it only for exploration, or if a oil company reinvests into an existing field like at Prudhoe Bay, you know, to get more oil out of the ground, would that also qualify for tax credit? Or if they're just expanding the pipe, is that a tax credit?
That's a very good question. No, there will be a definition, would have to be in the law, a definition of qualified capital expenditures, and that would set out in the law what qualifies and what doesn't qualify. In our economics, we assume that there will be a tax credit on all exploration expenditures, dry holes or any exploration expenditure, including geophysical and other expenditures. So that is point one. Point two, there will be tax credits on all capital investment. That capital investment, as I mentioned also here, is also true for reinvestment. So even if you would drill a single new well in Prudhoe Bay, that well would also receive the tax credit. Or if you install a new facility in Prudhoe Bay, that would also receive the tax credit. So the tax credit is a universal mechanism at the corporate level, and that is very important. We are not looking at the PPT on a field-by-field basis. So if a corporation has an interest in Prudhoe Bay and invests in wells in Prudhoe Bay and thus exploration in Cook Inlet, they will be able to deduct credits for both activities from their income.
Make one comment to that. You wonder if capital costs get a credit and operating costs don't, there's going to be an incentive to shift things from capital to operating. However, what's capital and what's operating is going to be defined by federal terms in the federal income taxation. Under federal taxation, there's an incentive to make things operating rather than capital, because if they're operating, you can deduct it right away. Where it's capital, you have to depreciate it. So that federal code actually is a self-enforcing mechanism to hinder that incentive to shift costs between operating and capital.
Okay, very good. And Madam Chair, if I could follow up on a question Senator Terrio had.
Director.
Thank you. On your chart here, you know, of course, we're competing worldwide for investment dollars, and we would like to have these investment dollars in Alaska. And on your chart here, the best place for a oil company right now to invest, correct me if I'm wrong, is the Gulf Coast or the U.S. Gulf of Mexico.
That's absolutely true, at least among the 10 examples that I gave here. Actually, I do typically analysis of all of the say 140 countries around the world and all of the more than 400 systems in the world, and the absolute most attractive system in the world is Palau, but Of course, there is no oil there. So, consequently, there is definitely an inverse relationship between government take and investment. But the U.S. Gulf has an attractive fiscal system by international standards. There is absolutely no doubt about it. Very attractive system. It became more attractive, relatively speaking, with the increase in the British government take. It also became relatively more attractive, of course, with the increases in government take in Venezuela and other countries. So no doubt that many oil companies will consider the U.S. Gulf a very attractive area for exploration and production, and that is why there is such immense interest in the area. So obviously that is definitely the case. Alaska will not be able to compete fiscally with that high level of attraction. So what we are trying to achieve is the art of the possible and say, how can we make Alaska more attractive? How can we create a system in place that attracts new investors, but that is still within the reasonableness of what Alaska really needs to earn from its resources. The federal government, of course, has a wide range of other possible income sources that Alaska may not have.
Okay, very good. And then just one other place. Canada is another place that we're obviously competing with, and I see Alberta is, again, a better place to invest than what you're proposing here. But is that because they're giving extra tax credits or tax breaks for the heavy oil?
Actually, that is why on my slide I refer to Alberta oil sands. If you actually look at conventional oil, the Alberta system is tougher than the PPT that we would be proposing. Under current oil prices, Alberta royalties are 27% across the board. So that gives you of a very strong fiscal system. And consequently, under current high oil prices and high gas prices, the Alberta has a sliding scale royalty that goes up progressively with price very strongly. And consequently, under the current high oil prices, for sure, Alberta is, for conventional oil, somewhat tougher. They would rate probably approximately like the Alaska current system. However, that is why I mentioned the oil sands. Alberta has had a very strong policy to encourage oil sand development, very successful policy. They are heading for about 2 million barrels a day right now by 2010. And that has been achieved by actually eliminating the royalties altogether and replacing the royalties with a PPT-style feature. So that, of course, is more attractive. Eliminating the royalties altogether is not something I like to recommend to the legislature.
Okay, very good. And then, Madam Chair, yes. If I may, oil sands in Alberta would compare to our Wesak field in Alaska. Is that safe to say, heavy oil?
I wouldn't be able to make a detailed comparison because I haven't seen detailed cash flow comparison. But oil sands these days, the technology has improved very significantly. And typically, I like to also point out, of course, that there is an immense difference in wellhead value. Like in Wesak, at $22 oil, obviously the wellhead value would be too low for heavy oil in Alaska to be economic, while it isn't in Alberta. Oil sands development were announced even in the late 80s and early 90s when oil prices were as low as $12 a barrel. So that gives you an idea that oil sand development are probably somewhat more attractive today than Wesak heavy oil, particularly if you take the lower wellhead value into account.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Van Meers, if you took the entire array, you gotta peek around, the entire array of PPT systems in the world, what percentage of those would be coupled to the investment credit system?
Actually, there are not that many PPT systems in the world that will work with a tax credit. And the reason is that the vast majority of the PPT style systems are actually production sharing style contracts, and they are field by field, so the tax credits cannot really be used outside. It is field specific. However, every nation, or the vast majority of nations who has a PPT style system, has also a feature to protect the smaller fields. Norway did it, and they do it in different ways. Norway has what is called an uplift. So Norway permits to deduct, for instance, 130% of the capital cost rather than 100%. Australia has a special feature that is based on the rate of return, whereby you don't have to pay the tax until you bump into a particular level of rate of return. So each kind of developed nation that has a PPT style structure similar to Alaska thought of some feature to make the system more attractive for marginal fields or small companies, etc. The reason that it is suggested here to go for the tax credit system is that the tax credits are tradable, and that is actually a very important characteristic. And it is precisely the fact that the tax credits are tradable which makes the new fiscal system so attractive for a new entrant. Since Alaska has a specific policy of actually attracting the new companies, tradable tax credits are a far more efficient way of doing that than uplifts or rate of return based systems or other features that are being used in other countries. Do other countries have tax credits? Yes, there are tax credits in other countries, but this is actually a rather specific application of tax credits that is quite unique from that perspective, but it was proposed in order to specifically help the smaller explorers and encourage new investors to come to Alaska.
Continue.
The seems to me ideal that if we're going to address oil, that both the oil piece and the contract for gas be on the table at the same time. That's the best situation, it would seem to me, for as a legislator anyway. Would there be any scenario that would make sense where we finished one first and then went on with the other? I mean, it seems to me that both of them on deck gives us much better shot at understanding the total picture here as a legislator. Any disagreement with that?
No. The what I understand from the commissioner is that the concept is that, of course, the stranded gas contract is only being negotiated with three companies for a very specific project. This law is meant to be a law of general application across Alaska. So the first concept is that if there is going to be a change to the tax, first we need to evaluate, is this change by itself good for Alaska, yes or not? Once the legislature has come forward with a specific law, specific figures, and specific, say, numbers, and has crystallized the PPT in legislation, then there is the opportunity to go back to the gas contract and say, how does this whole picture now hangs together, as you were suggesting? Because it is only logical that this oil law is a decision, and then the next decision is, now we know what the oil law is, and we look at the gas contract. Does the whole thing now make sense? And that is the second step. But as the commissioner said, this law should be a good law with or without a stranded gas contract.
And last, Madam Chair. If we look at this as a legislature, two bodies, it would be nice, it would seem to me, if there's a model for doing this, both of these deals with a free government, that might be worth looking at as we try to figure out how to proceed. What do you know of, you know, when you look at the task ahead of us, do you have thoughts about how we should proceed? I mean, this is certainly an educational come up to speed thing we're doing here, and we've been in these venues increasingly, and I think that's excellent, so that we have a better understanding of what to do. Any models out there for how we go ahead, outlines, any thoughts from you on that?
No, as I understand from the commissioner and the government, and as I have heard it and as I'm instructed as a consultant, the concept is not to bury somehow this petroleum law in a stranded gas contract. That would be the wrong thing to do. So the idea is to, as some people seem to think, I mean, that is clearly not the concept. The concept is to bring forward this PPT law. This law has to be good for Alaska, in the opinion of the legislature, on its own merit. Once that law has been passed, then we can step back and say, now we have the stranded gas contract here. Here is the new law. How does the whole universe hang together? And with the knowledge of the PPT, you can now judge the stranded gas contract far better than you could before, and say, okay, here is the new stranded gas contract. These are the terms as the Stranded Gas Act requires us to do. There will be a public hearing process of 30 days or more, and then it will go to the legislature for a vote. And now you can vote in the full knowledge of the oil tax already existing, so that you can look at the whole picture. That is really a very good situation, and that is what I think the scenario is. Would that be fair to say?
Mr. Vamures said exactly what I made in my opening statement.
We have time for one more question, and Senator Stevens, because we're well past our time limit in here.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Marks, referring to your slide on figure 12, page 20.
Which page?
That's correct, yeah. I find this to be a fascinating chart here. So let me just see if I summarize it. This is the life of, this is a term, that's what you said, till 50 years then?
It's 45 years, between 2006 and 2050.
A cumulative revenue stream of $1 trillion?
Gross, that's the West Coast price times the volume.
So could I properly assume that you could take that same bar graph distribution and annualize it, and that would just be the culmination of the distributions on an annual basis, on average?
The problem is the capital costs are, you don't have capital costs every single year, but it could, you know, generally, you spend money for capital early on, but one could probably make adjustments.
So you could maybe every 5 to 10 years. Or
put it on a depreciation basis.
Let's stay back to that one.
This actually is the graph. Yeah, the comes very close to that. Yes.
On a linear basis. Yeah.
On an annual basis.
But so back to that slide, figure 12. So the top three portions of the bar graph are expenses.
Right. And actually, the pre-tax expenses, and as you go down, capital, operating, transportation, and property taxes and royalties are the same whether you have a PPT or the current.
Right, but I'm looking at terms of take. So the top three pieces are operating take, expense take. The next three, property, royalty, state, and severance, are state take, and then the Fed take, and then corporate take. But I find interesting in there, you made a comment that the feds pick up 1/3 of the total change in take. Is that what you said?
I said the PPT would be deductible for federal income taxation, and you know, the federal income tax rate, say it's 35%, they would, since that's deductible on net to the producers, you know, they pay 35% less federal income tax because of the PPT. So you see that with the federal income tax, that maroon, that chunk next to the bottom, federal income taxes actually go down because the PPT went up. Because in terms of corporate take, you know, 35% of the PPT is a deduction for federal income taxes. So the feds would pick up 35% of the PPT bill. And on net, the producers would pick up the other 65% of it at, you know, after tax.
Right.
Does that make sense?
I just wanted you to explain that again. I find that to be significant in the discussions of and in the interpretation of this, that we pick up the tax, whereas instead of the federal government, because they're going to pay the tax anyway. Let's just take, for instance, if it stayed the same, the corporate tax liability of the corporation would go up anyway under this scenario, and we would be picking up the tax instead. But that's for another concentration. Now I've lost my train of thought on my final question here. But then you said, so when looking at the yellow piece on the right-hand scale, that would actually be changed from severance to PPT then, right?
Yes. The increase in the size of the yellow from the left-hand column to the right is the additional PPT.
Okay, now I remember what I was going to make a comment about. So this is, and this is sort of off the subject, Madam Chairman, but if you'll allow me to change for a minute. So this is over the course of the this includes a pipeline in place, right?
Yeah, this is with the gas.
Enhanced oil production over the course of a 45-year period. So if I read that right, that Alaska will contribute approximately $300 billion to the federal treasury. Is that about right? 27%, what'd you say it would be? Whatever the federal take is on that side?
So how much money from Alaska goes to the feds?
That's
that
right.
Looks to be about $200 billion.
$200 billion?
Just eyeballing it.
Yes.
Out of the trillion dollars total.
Today, the total 100% is a trillion. I mean, it may be, this is really agonizing sinking in blocks of $200 billion. But if we make blocks of $200 billion, here we see. Each 20% is actually $200 billion. So you see here the federal tax on the total Alaska production. The federal government gains $200 billion.
And over a course of how many years?
Over 45 years.
45 years. So we're contributing $200 billion to the federal treasury. And the finance chairs, and we receive how much money annually from the federal treasury?
Couple of billion.
$3 billion. Three? So it's about half of what we put in. We take back half of what we put in.
This is.
So I'm pontificating here, countering what's constantly being said about us, especially recently, is that we're a state that takes more than what we supply. And here we've just demonstrated in economic numbers that we have the potential to contribute $200 billion, and we get labeled for being on the take for taking half of what we give back.
Of course, a lot of that $200 billion simply attributable to the magic of compound inflation at 2% over 45 years.
I think we ought to give these to the people that the administration hires to go increase the awareness and the position of Alaska in its national campaign is about the fact that we are net providers to the federal treasury. Thank you,
Senator Stevens. Thank you very much Stevens for your presentation. And I'm sure that any of these people have questions like for you, you'll be able to
hear them. That is an interesting chart. That's cool.
We are adjourned. Now.